Hi folks, and thanks for listening to this Tortoise Shack podcast. Little bit of housekeeping before we kick off. We have a very special conversation myself and Martin recorded just in relation to how I did and did not do RTEs up front. It ended up in the editorial bin in RTE, but we plucked it out and we've put it together just for our listeners, and it's available right now on patreon.com/tortoiseshack, much to the chagrin of RTE themselves. But I think, you know, if you're not going to use it, I certainly am. Also want to say thank you to everybody who supported the Bring Back Zach campaign. Incredible generosity, particularly from the Tortoise Shack listeners. It's phenomenal to see that amount of money raised so quickly. And Zach's family were overwhelmed. So thank you for all your help on that. Finally, again, I have to ask you, if you're not a member, please join us. We've no ads, we've no sponsors. We rely entirely on you to keep it going. It's not a one-way street. You got lots and lots of exclusives and all of our podcasts in one consolidated feed, entirely plea-free. So please click that link. It says patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and folks, this morning I have to fly solo because events have been like that. My colleague is no longer, he's no longer able to stand up at the moment because poor old Martin has had a bad run of it. As you know, he's been suffering a long time. As a cancer survivor, and he has had bad mornings. So this is one of those mornings. So I'm going to say something that I seldom say. Hope you're feeling better, buddy. I generally don't really give you much love, but you know, I hope you're feeling a bit better this morning. And I am thrilled to be joined on the podcast by UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights Defenders, Mary Lawler. Mary, it's probably a bad time to be joined by you, but unfortunately from the media perspective, a really good time to be talking to you because there's a lot going on, and I suppose we have to start where the eyes of the world are right now this morning in Gaza and the events that we've seen. Before we maybe talk about a specific event or what has been argued over the last 12, 24 hours, do you want to give a little bit of context to first of all, what's happening and your role as a human rights defender, as a UN Special Rapporteur in that position?
Yes, and thank you very much for having me. And I get a lot of my information from human rights defenders on the ground in Gaza. I've been there twice myself. But it is, as you well know, a completely barbaric situation. We're talking about, to date, 32,623 people killed, of whom 14,000 are children, little children, and 70% are women and children. And there's another 75,000 injured. And in the West Bank, you also see the violence by settlers. So you have 438 Palestinians who've been killed, including 106 children. Now, these statistics just keep going up and up. Every time I do something else about Gaza, I have to go back to my notes and revise my statistics. And what we're seeing is, whether people like it or not, we're seeing collective punishment, we're seeing complete breakdown of international law and international humanitarian law. We are seeing war crimes. We're seeing a judgment of plausible genocide by the court, and even in the last couple of days, the ruling by the court that aid should be allowed into Gaza. It is a situation at the moment where, and it's not just the civilians, of course, in Gaza. UNRWA has been blocked from delivering aid. UNRWA was basically the only thing that kept Gaza going when I was there, because they were doing the schools, the hospitals, the food, and 172 of them have been killed. And then we get to the health workers and the humanitarian aid workers, and we've seen yesterday how seven members of the organization, food organization,
World Food Kitchen,
were killed. And you know, it's the same as with any of the other, like the ambulance strikes or the UNRWA buildings where they have been targeted. You know, everyone gives Israel their coordinates. Israel knows the coordinates of everything that is passing. Mm-hmm. So when this food truck was passing through a deconflicted area, and it had its logo on the side of the van. And yet they were still killed. And we've seen that over and over again. We've seen it in the way that ambulances have been targeted outside Al Shifa. And of course, we saw the complete and utter destruction of Al Shifa Hospital just the other day, with hundreds killed, including some more doctors. Mm-hmm. You know, doctors are there to heal and to try and make people better and to act in a completely humanitarian way. And yet they've been targeted in some cases as well. And of course, the situation for journalists, we know so many journalists have been killed in Gaza simply because they're doing their job, which is, and they're human rights defenders, because they are putting themselves in grave danger to try and report on what is happening. We also had one killed in southern Lebanon as well. So you know, I'm the rapporteur on human rights defenders. So my job is to try and protect human rights defenders and draw attention to their plight. And so many human rights defenders in the Gaza Strip and in West Bank have been attacked and killed. And in that cohort of people, I include journalists, mm-hmm. I include doctors and medical workers and ambulance drivers, and I include people working for NGOs, many of whom I know, both in Israel and in Gaza.
You make a really interesting point, because just so listeners, for listeners' benefit, Israel know exactly who you are, where you are. They can strike within meters. My late friend Rifat Al-Arir, who was targeted and killed with his sister and her husband and their children, he was in a UNRWA building when he received a call to say he was going to be struck, and he left there to make sure that no one else would die. Made his way to his sister's to gather provisions, and they were able to strike right to where he was, and they knew. So the idea that these are kind of, to use the awful phrase, collateral damage or accidental things, and you know, they're actually, and you may have seen this, Mary, in the last sort of 48 hours, they're using some of the things they're doing in urban, what they're calling urban warfare, to sell potential weapons of war to other communities. You know, they're using Gaza as a sandbox for these weapons of war for urban warfare. So it's kind of disgusting. But if I could return really quickly to the human rights defenders, you mentioned the your role as the rapporteur. Have you found, though, that because essentially Israel has also decided to attack the rapporteurs and attack your organization within the UN, how has that, you know, like, because that just changes the rules entirely. It's like saying, well, we don't even have to listen to you guys because you're either anti-Semitic or on the side of Hamas. It's one or the other, or both.
Well, it is part of the territory, not just in relation to Gaza, but, you know, if you're an independent expert of the UN, which I am, you're not working for the UN, you're not working for states, and you're not working for a non-governmental organisation. And you're appointed by the member states of the Human Rights Council with a very specific mandate. And that's what all of us who are doing this work do. Now, in the case of the special rapporteur on the occupied territories, Francesca Albanese, she has been vilified and targeted simply because she is doing her work. And you can go onto the UN website and she's supposed to follow and report on the situation in the occupied territories. And that goes back, I mean, it's not just Francesca, going back over the years, other rapporteurs have been attacked as well. I do think, you know, it is really sad to see that when you have the majority in the General Assembly passing a resolution for a ceasefire, you now have a Security Council resolution on a ceasefire. And also you have the Commission of Inquiry that has been set up. Also, the whole world is looking for a ceasefire and Israel refuses to listen. So I really think there has to be an arms embargo. And that's what the defenders are telling me. And, you know, when you talked about your friend, I also had a friend, a woman in the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. And my last picture of her is her sitting with a pen and paper with women and children. Mm. In what looked like a burnt out shelter garage type thing, where she is taking testimony, because her role in the organization was to document the rights of women and children. And when we come to children, my heart is broken. I mean, you just think of all those poor little babies and small children and the terror that they face every night. Wondering, you know, with the bombs raining down and the awful injuries, the burns and the shrapnel and the broken bones and the amputations and the lack of medical care and the lack of functioning hospitals. And the fact that even the basic living conditions, like one in 800, there's only one toilet for 800 people. And a shower for 3,500 in Rafah. I mean, geez, can you imagine just trying to survive in those conditions? And with one in three hospitals only partially working, and eight out of the 24 UNRWA centers, health centers, are not operational, because now, as you know, Israel has been attacking the centers and also refusing to cooperate with UNRWA. I do need to say this. The hostages should be released. I have no time for Hamas. They are complete and absolute thugs. To go in and kill innocent Jewish people just in, you know, minding their own business and taking all those hostages is also a war crime. So I have no time for
Hamas.
But that being said, what we have seen, the scale and the lack of proportionate response by Israel over the civilian population of Gaza is against all international humanitarian law and international law, because in war, the Geneva Conventions were brought in to rule the conduct of war. Mm. And what you have now is the Geneva Conventions specifically say that there are rules for warring parties, and they also specifically say that civilians have to be protected.
I will say that while I agree with you that what happened on October 7th is absolutely reprehensible, there are also calls for that to be investigated properly and given, so we would know, understand. And Israel has not actually played ball there either. Nor will they play ball within Gaza. So, you know, I know this is not in any way a defense of Hamas, but we need to see actual investigations into what happened, because we are still at a stage where there's awful things are being reported and then revised and reported and revised. And we just, you know, I think people need to be held accountable for what they did. Their actions need to be held accountable, whether it be individuals, whether it be groups. And absolutely, I accept that. But can we just focus on the international institutions though? What we have seen over the last 6 months is an undermining of international institutions. And as someone in your position, that must be very troubling.
Well, actually, it is quite marked in that even when I was there presenting my report in Geneva the other week, one of the ambassadors whom I know came over to me and he just said, you know, Mary, he said, I think that the next big battle here at the UN will be exactly what you're saying, the undermining of the international institutions. And if you look at it, though, like on the one hand, you have all these member states of the UN, and the majority of them have passed a resolution, you know, and the security. But then on the other hand, you have people like the US, Israel, and Germany and the UK, you know, all well, to be fair, some of them have moved a bit along the way, but for example, the US still supplies 68% of the weapons to Israel, and Germany upped its weapons, upped its export of weapons from 32 million to over 300 million.
Wow, like that's and in the last 24 hours, we've heard reports that they're going to again increase funding for Israel from the US by 18 billion, an additional 18 billion. I mean, you can't have like this. Again, I agree with you that, yes, we've seen countries, you know, step up to the plate. We've seen South Africa step up to the plate. We've seen Ireland recently decide that they'll add their imprimatur to the South African case. We don't know what shape that's going to take yet, but nonetheless, it's a significant, you know, something that needs to be marked. But, you know, we absolutely need to see more. And unfortunately, with the ruling of plausible genocide by the ICJ, we haven't seen any of the things that were said. You know, you've 30 days to come back and comply with these things. Actually, everything has gotten worse. And the day after, we've mentioned UNRWA several times, the day after the ruling, they decided to just fully attack UNRWA and undermine it, its credibility. Like, I know so many Palestinians who would be delighted if UNRWA didn't exist, because if UNRWA didn't exist, that would mean they had independence and the right of return, and they'd have their own, statehood and some integrity. But UNRWA exists purely because of the fallout of 1948 and what happened since then.
Yeah, and I mean, but, you know, you also have to, the practicalities on the ground, you know, the Gaza Strip is, as you know, like an open air prison, and it's the size of Wexford, and it's been under blockade for 16 years by land, sea and air. So when that is the case, when people aren't allowed, develop their own economy, I always think it would be the most wonderful tourist area. Because you have that beautiful coastline, you have the most amazing vegetables and the most amazing fruits. And what I found with some of my human rights defenders friends, because the situation has been so awful and depressing for so many years, you know, it was quite marked to me that a lot of them, they come home from work and they go to their garden and they dig and they create and they grow. It's almost like, you know, it's an antithesis to all the attacks and the killings, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I was there after one of the intifadas, and what I couldn't understand was the cruelty whereby chicken farms and strawberry farms were bombed.
Beekeepers, they targeted beekeepers, they targeted goats, and even now we're seeing it is ecocide. It's ecocide, it's domicide, and it's a plausible genocide.
Well, of course, I don't, I am an independent expert of the UN, and I'm not a lawyer. And all these terms in international law, you know, they have specific meaning.
From our listeners' point of view, we've twice had Raj, the UN Special Rapporteur for Housing, on, and he's made the case for domicide. And I think it's well worth going. If you haven't listened to those, go back and listen to him. He makes a very good case. I know this sounds really strange, but it's also a very dangerous time globally for human rights defenders. And I just would like to focus on some of the things that we've been seeing. You've been very passionate about some of the things we've seen coming in Africa and indeed in Colombia. Ireland woke up in the last about a week ago to some of the things that have happened in Colombia in relation to the Cerrejón mine, which we've been covering on this podcast for nearly 6 years. It was nice to see primetime cover it, and it was nice to see it get a bit of coverage. But we've known that about these things for several years. Can we just talk about the state of how human rights defenders seem to be globally under? You know, it's actually getting harder. You would have thought it's 2024, things would be getting easier, but it seems to me, looking and following, that it seems to be getting harder.
Well, when you look at the situation of human rights defenders around the world, 400 plus human rights defenders are killed every year, usually in the context of extractive mining or big mega projects or, you know, agribusiness. I'm going to Brazil on Friday on an official country visit, and I will be going to three or four indigenous communities where some of their leaders have been killed in the context of business and human rights. One of the things I am glad to see is that the EU has just finally agreed the EU directive on mandatory human rights and environmental due diligence, which will force mainly only the very big companies, but these companies that are doing all this stuff are usually quite big, to properly engage with the stakeholders and the communities that are affected. But it only applies to companies that are headquartered in Europe and are either operating in Europe or elsewhere around the globe. But that leaves Canada and the US, which are ferocious abusers of human rights defenders, out of the loop. I'm going to Canada later in the year regarding this. But when you look at what else is happening to human rights defenders, I mean, women human rights defenders have always not only suffered the same kind of violations as men, the discrimination, you know, the attacks, the online attacks, the targeting, the imprisonment, the torture, the disappearance. That's the kind of scale of things that human rights defenders face. But with women, you have the added violation because of their gender, you know, the rape, the calling them sluts, the, you know, the bad mothers, the witches, all of that kind of stuff. And the online abuse is ferocious. So that is going on. Criminalization, false charges against human rights defenders, usually in the name of terrorism or some sort of, you know, charge that is anti-state or subversive.
Generally it moves into realms of treasonous type of behaviours. And can I say something for the benefit of listeners, if you don't mind? Just in relation to the EU making it something that they want to address, Ireland fought tooth and nail to have finance not included in these bills, because they knew that many of the big financial companies are situated along the docks in Dublin, and they're carrying out extractive practices in countries where, you know, where it's happening, like Brazil, like Colombia, like other places. And Ireland didn't want that to happen, because even though the offices are in Dublin, the actual breaches of human rights are happening elsewhere in the globe, and we would then be somehow responsible. We should be responsible, because that's where the money comes from. You know, it doesn't happen without the financial thing. So I think listeners should be made aware of that it's not just because it's a glass box on the keys doesn't mean it's not doing damage somewhere in a big mine somewhere.
Well, I've met Cerrejón myself. I met about 20 from all the different mining groups who are active. But you're quite right in that investment in people really should be doing ethical investments. And I am happy to say that has been a huge growth area in Ireland. In that a lot of, particularly myself included, but I was going to say a lot of young people are beginning, you know, when to try and make sure that their pension or their, you know, whatever they're putting their money towards in pensions, that they want ethical investments. So, I mean, I'm just hoping that that'll continue to grow and grow and grow. Of course, there will always be thugs all over the world who are just interested in the bottom line. But we had one lovely success lately with the Norwegian pension fund, which, as you know, is the biggest one in the world. And they agreed after we went to see them that they would not invest in, and they put it into their human rights policy, you know, that they, if there was a situation where human rights defenders were under threat, that they would not invest in that
company. That's great.
And we also gave an example. To be honest, you know, I mean, it's all very slow. Human rights work is just inch by inch. But we have seen some really good examples of where companies are being responsible. So, for example, you know, Adidas has a policy on human rights defenders. That's why you should buy Adidas and not Nike. But then on the other hand, I was in Paris 2 weeks ago and I had a meeting with Total, and Total have this huge pipeline in Uganda and it's going all the way to Tanzania. And they swear that they are doing everything absolutely properly. And they have all these great rhetoric about, you know, what they're doing. But the reality is on the ground, we still get, and it's all young people who are the defenders there in Uganda who don't want this pipeline running through the communities that are affected by them. So they're taking action.
Yeah. Just, I suppose if we bring this to a close though, in terms of the public's awareness now for, you know, when I say a term like human rights defenders, we kind of think of people who are, you know, strapped up wearing some sort of uniform and going out in there. But you've made the case just that it's journalists, it's NGO volunteers, it's people who are. So if you were to say, is it something that hasn't been well understood is that part of the difficulty of the role?
Yeah. The UN adopted the Declaration on Human Rights Defenders in 1998 after 13 years discussion. And basically it says that any individual or organization has the right and responsibility to promote and protect human rights and fundamental freedoms. Now, obviously, there can be many human rights defenders around the world who are not in danger, but I only concentrate on the ones who are in danger because of their human rights work. And yes, it can be. For example, one of my best friends in Sudan is an engineer. He's a man whom I absolutely adore. He's been doing human rights work. I've known him for about 20 years. He's been imprisoned about 7 times. He's been held in scorching heat, open ground in the summer and freezing cold in the winter. He's been given these spurious charges where they have said that the death penalty could be applied. He was being put in solitary confinement in so often when he was in jail that he used to be begging to talk to the warders. I mean, and he still does that work. And right now he's in Sudan documenting and trying to support the communities. And he just, I spoke to him there. Of course, the internet is really bad. He's in Darfur. It's back. It's like it was way back, you know, in the decade or so ago.
The last time they actually said it was genocide, and this time we had more arguments over. But nonetheless,
but in the Masalit community, all the women are being raped and tortured. The houses are being burned, and nobody's talking about Sudan. You know, Sudan, Afghanistan. You see, the problem is there are so many parts of the world that are in such terrible conflict. And yet, because of the nature of humanity and human concentration, it just moves from one to the other.
I'm conscious of time, and I really appreciate it. But I will say, we've covered Afghanistan with Hannah McCarthy, who's been doing brilliant reporting. She's been in and out, and we've spoken to other people who, you know, work with the NGOs in terms of the food insecurity there. That is only now, you know, the only place it's just been one. You know, people didn't know where one meal was coming from. Never mind the next, you know, the next two meals, they couldn't plan ahead. And we know what these situations are like, but there's also, unfortunately, there's also a geopolitical game that's going on in the background, and that's a whole other conversation for another day in terms of this. But I really, really appreciate, first of all, the work that you do, you giving us your time, and continue to speak out and continue to be an advocate for human rights defenders. And it is a thankless position in many ways, but believe me, there's a lot of people on the ground who benefit from that, your advocacy, and benefit from what's happening. So thank you for your time, and thank you so much for the work that you do.
Thanks for having me.
No problem.
Good luck.
We keep going. Listen, folks, we will be back. I'm actually talking to, we have a member of the Palestinian diaspora from Germany, I believe, later on this evening. And Yusuf Al-Jamal in Istanbul will be rejoining us. We will talk to you all very, very soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.